today on Against the Grain, Sheldon Wolin invoked the specter of what he called inverted totalitarianism. He inveighed as well against U.S. superpower and managed democracy. David McIver believes that some of the claims the late Sheldon Wolin made about political resistance and democracy have been misunderstood. I'm C.S. David McIver discusses power, politics, and the prospects for radical democracy coming right up. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Who was Sheldon Wolin, this man who Cornel West called the greatest political theorist of democracy of our time? Wolin was a professor and public intellectual who wrote about state power and corporate power and the threats posed to democracy in this nation. In his 2008 book, Democracy Incorporated, Sheldon Wolin invoked the specter of what he called inverted totalitarianism. In an essay published more than a decade earlier, he put forward a concept of fugitive democracy. Sheldon Wolin died in October 2015 at the age of 93, but his arguments still resonate, and his ideas have been taken up and examined by many scholars, including David McIver, a political science professor at Colorado State University. McIver, like a number of other thinkers, has pointed to Wolin's assertion that democracy is a, quote, fugitive experience, but McIver thinks that assertion has been misinterpreted. David McIver is the author of Morning in America, Race and the Politics of Loss, and he wrote an article about Sheldon Wolin and this notion of fugitive democracy for the journal New Political Science. When David McIver joined me from his studio at Colorado State University, I asked how important issues of democracy and democratic practice are to him.
Well, it's deeply important to me as a political theorist, and I actually just call myself a democratic theorist, and one of the classes I teach here at Colorado State University is a democratic theory class, and try to convince students that democracy is not just a form of government, but a form of life and something that they can sort of shape their being around and through.
And how concerned was Sheldon Wolin with what was happening to democracy in the United States?
Deeply concerned would be an understatement. One of Wolin's last books was called Democracy Incorporated, Managed Democracy and the Specter of Inverted Totalitarianism, where he makes a somewhat polemical argument that the democracy, the liberal democracy that we currently inhabit and enjoy and in some respects take for granted, has been for a long time moving away from a sort of robust understanding and practice of democracy, to the extent that we may not even be able to refer to our tradition in those terms anymore.
What did Wolin see as the obstacles to democratic practice and democratic aspirations, to the operation of democracy?
Well, the answer to that is about three or four books, and I can try to give you the abbreviated version. But Wolin thinks that American democracy has sort of been struggling with itself since the era of the founding. Wolin thinks that there are two somewhat distinct understandings, sets of practices of democracy in the American political tradition. And the first he associates with kind of the pre-colonial America, the Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation, the writings of the Anti-Federalists, in which the demos, the people, are seen as sort of an active political force. And then competing with that tradition is sort of an alternative tradition represented probably most forcefully in the Federalist Papers and in the Constitution, which replaces the Articles of Confederation. And in that understanding of democracy, the demos is seen as a relatively passive entity. Power is something outside of the grasp of the demos or the people. And Wolin thinks that the second tradition, the tradition of the Federalist Papers and the Constitution, more or less won out at the era of the founding and the decades after the founding, and has sort of become the paramount or dominant understanding of citizenship, which he finds deeply problematic because of this, again, this understanding that the demos is a relatively passive actor. So this is sort of Wolin's concern with democracy in America.
He used the term, he coined the term, I think, superpower, initial caps, superpower. What is that according to Sheldon Wolin?
Yeah, well, so to understand the concept of superpower, you have to, again, sort of trace back all the way really to the founding. So this will allow me to kind of elaborate this second conception of democracy, where the demos is a relatively passive agent, because that doesn't mean that a society, the society envisioned by the founders, he really has Hamilton in mind. I think it's a mild irony of our time that, you know, Alexander Hamilton has become this kind of pop culture figure and been reappropriated for a multicultural America, because Hamilton sort of becomes the enemy or the target in a lot of Wolin's work. And when this conception of democracy that sort of dethrones the demos, turns it into a relatively passive agent, it doesn't mean that that political society is not concerned with the generation of power. But the generation of power happens in the sphere of the economy. So how the demos can participate in power is basically participating in the division of labor and in economic productivity. And that's how society generates power. This is sort of Hamilton's explicit vision, both in the Federalist Papers that he wrote and in his writings afterwards. And Wolin says that how a society thinks about and generates power reflects how it thinks about civic identity, right? The role of a citizen, the place of a citizen in society. And in turning the economy, in turning the role of production and the division of labor into the source for the generation and maintenance of power, Wolin thinks that we develop, again, this passive understanding of democracy. And that's the basis for superpower. That's the basis for superpower, where superpower becomes the explicit alignment an alliance between the state and capital accumulation, basically, the economy. And that's, you know, again, you have to go way back into the 18th century to sort of see the roots of this. But Wolin thinks it's become even more apparent in the sort of post-World War II era. So one of the aspects of this sort of passive understanding of democracy is that identification becomes a symbolic identification with areas and spheres of power generation. So we identify as citizens because of our great and powerful economy. We identify as citizens because of our great and powerful military. And this really sort of heightens after World War II, when America sort of becomes this global superpower. American capitalism becomes hyper-developed. Technology becomes hyper-developed. And Wolin sees this sort of alignment between science, technology, the state, and capital, creating this constellation of incredible powers, which he terms superpower. And the big indictment of superpower for Wolin is that it doesn't allow a space for democracy in the sort of original understanding of democracy. So the original word democracy just means the power, kratos, is a word for power, the capacity to act, the capacity to do things, so the power of the people. And Wolin thinks in an era of superpower, democracy is crowded out, if not completely dissolved.
So much more to say about Sheldon Wolin and what he understood about power and the generation of power and what democracy is and how it could possibly respond to the exigencies of power or the reality of power in the modern era. But I want to talk about fugitive democracy, which is what you focus on in an article you wrote for the journal New Political Science. And this is a term, well, Sheldon Wolin used that term fugitive to describe democracy. There's a lot to say about it in the affirmative, but maybe we could start with how it's been interpreted. And then we can talk about how you are pushing back, perhaps, against that interpretation. So, for example, the Princeton professor, Jeffrey Stout, how did he interpret Wolin's idea of fugitive democracy?
So Wolin wrote an essay in the mid-1990s called Fugitive Democracy. And in that piece, he sort of makes a claim that democracy is not really a form of government, it's not really an institution, or that at least forms of government and institutions of governance might be hostile towards democracy. So that maybe democracy should be reconceptualized as sort of a moment in time, right? A moment of resistance or protest against these forms, against these institutions, which seem to be exclusive of democracy. This has become probably one of Wolin's most famous late pieces or later pieces in his work, to the extent that a new volume of his essays, which was just recently published, is called Fugitive Democracy and Other Essays. So this has taken up a lot of attention and interpreters and readers of Wolin who have focused on this concept of fugitive democracy. And most people find it problematic. And they find it problematic because it seems to indicate that democracy sort of burns itself out through its exercise. That democracy is about these sort of romantic eruptions or moments of transgression or resistance, but that it doesn't really leave any trace. It doesn't sort of build any institutions or constitutions around itself to sort of sustain and endure. So Jeffrey Stout, among others, sort of criticizes Wolin for this concept, and he basically thinks of it as a term of despair, of democratic despair, that all democracy can hope for are these moments of eruption, these moments of transgression or resistance. And Stout sees the work of democracy as being much more open than that. He sees the possibility of democratic institutions much more plausible than Wolin sees them. And he especially thinks that the people, the demos, individuals and citizens, can organize to hold those institutions and institutional actors accountable for their actions. And he thinks fugitive democracy sort of moves us away from thinking institutionally, from thinking about accountability. And it's basically a note of despair for Stout and others.
David McIver joins us. He's assistant professor of political science at Colorado State University. He has written a piece about the political theorist Sheldon Wolin and the prospects for radical democracy that appeared in the September issue of the journal New Political Science. He's also author of Mourning in America, Race and the Politics of Loss. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. What do you think in general, and we'll get more specific over the course of the hour, but what do you think generally about this argument that by focusing on fugitivity, by focusing on fugitive democracy, Wolin was in fact speaking from a standpoint of despair and perhaps even defeatism?
Well, I'm of two minds on this. On the one hand, these interpreters are not altogether wrong. So Wolin does talk about democracy in terms of its momentary appearances. Wolin does seem largely, I think despair is too strong a word, but Wolin is pessimistic given the arraignment of forces and obstacles and forms of power that sort of set themselves against democracy. And not just forms of power, but ways that we sort of inhabit our political space. Wolin thinks that we've sort of lost the habits of thinking of ourselves and acting as democratic citizens. So, you know, I think these authors, these interpreters of Wolin get a lot right about fugitive democracy. But on the other hand, Wolin doesn't think that democracy is only limited to these moments of eruption or resistance or transgression or refusal or protest. Those moments, Wolin thinks, can actually educate us into becoming what he calls political beings. And that educative task of turning ourselves into inhabiting this position of democratic beings or political beings is actually the larger task of his political theory, which spans over five decades. So I think when you contextualize the fugitive democracy argument and this emphasis on democracy as something which is resistant to or different from forms, institutions, embodiments, when you contextualize it in this broader challenge that Wolin sort of sets before himself as a democratic theorist, of inciting this democratic consciousness or this conscience, which presents various ways of engaging in political activities and seizing political opportunities, then the fugitive part of democracy is just one piece. It's just one piece of the larger puzzle. And so I think we overemphasize, I think interpreters of Wolin overemphasize the fugitivity in democracy. And they neglect or they downplay the sort of emphasis on continuity, on cultural patterns of politicalness, on shaping ourselves as political beings, which is Wolin's larger task.
Tell us more about what Wolin would have us do as far as remembering or recalling certain moments of the past, eruptions perhaps of democratic possibilities or democratic instincts, and why that's important to cultivating a kind of political consciousness in the present.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the paper, I say, you know, the work of contextualizing Wolin's understanding of fugitive democracy, you know, you have to sort of put it next to different registers in his theorizing. One of those registers is invocation. And to explain that, let me back up a little bit. Wolin wrote a famous piece called Political Theory as a Vocation in the 1960s. And Wolin had a strong sense that the role of political theory is to be sort of a caretaker of the common, a caretaker of the political. And I can talk more about the relationship for Wolin between the political and the common. But then in about 40 years after he wrote that piece, he wrote another piece saying from vocation to invocation. And there was a sense in which you need to shift to a register of invocation, invoking things that have been lost, right? Paying attention to things that have been lost or neglected, thrown aside. And Wolin thinks that really what has been neglected, thrown aside, both in political theorizing, in the sort of American Academy perspective, but also in American political culture, is this legacy of politicalness, a legacy of democracy where the demos, the people, are seen as an active force, an active actor in politics. And again, this goes back to this, ancient tradition, well, ancient tradition, but ancient in our context, tradition of political thinking and acting associated with the Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation, pre-colonial experience of relative self-governance. So Wolin thinks that one of the tasks of political theory is to sort of practice this work of retrieval, what he calls writing essays of retrieval, where you retrieve these moments from history, and in fact he goes all the way back 2,500 years ago to ancient democratic experiments in Athens, Greece, retrieve these moments of democratic possibility so that you can understand what's possible, so that you can understand how the demos can sort of act, how the demos can seize and claim the kratos, the power that's baked into, built into the concept of democracy. So the essays in retrieval are really attempts to sort of broaden our political imagination and sort of shatter the boundaries, the relatively narrow boundaries of our political imagination, which has been shaped by a particular political tradition. In particular, this second political tradition that he identifies in the American political tradition, where the demos, the people, are seen as a relatively passive actor.
And do tell us about the relationship you see or he saw between the political, or what he called politicalness, and the common or the common good.
Yeah, so Wolin uses terms in ways that may be unfamiliar to people who haven't read a lot of Sheldon Wolin. So Wolin says there's a difference between politics and the political. Politics is kind of this ceaseless activity where people compete to sort of get a hold of the sources of authority and power in a society, right? So competitive elections, interest group politics, right? That's politics. The political, he says, is this ability to know and to value, right? To know and to value how we can participate in and be responsible for the care and improvement of our common life together. Right. So again, the knowledge and the valuing of our ability to participate and be responsible for the common. And again, he sees political theory as playing a sort of caretaker role of the political, right? Calling to our attention and remembering these moments when the political happened. So that's the connection between the common and the political for Wolin, right? That the political is about the care and concern for that which is common between us. And he sees that those moments where we claim our politicalness, where we act politically, are relatively rare. Politics, he says, is ceaseless. It's constant. It's always going on. The political, by contrast, is somewhat rare, and it appears occasionally, right?
What example, what other historical examples of democratic moments worth invoking, worth retrieving, worth remembering did Wolin identify, you know, maybe a more recent historical example?
Yeah, absolutely. So the abolitionist movement is sort of primary in Wolin's mind. I mean, we talk about Lincoln freeing the slaves. Lincoln did not free the slaves, right? Abolitionism freed the slaves. And abolitionism was the result of decades and decades of agitation and organizing, right? The organization of these abolition assemblies, right? Abolition societies. And that's a moment. Those are moments where people who are differentially placed within the polity come together for a common purpose, come together to sort of cultivate a sense for the common and common commitments, right? People that didn't seem to have a direct stake in this said, no, we have a stake in this because we are connected, right? We are connected through a sense of the common. So the abolitionist movement is one for Woolen. The civil rights movement is one for Woolen. The anti-nuclear movement, the ecological movements in the 60s, Woolen was at Berkeley during the free speech movement, and this had sort of a foundational effect on his thinking, because he saw this as a moment where people sort of said, these issues are too important for me to be on the sideline. I need to sort of claim my politicalness. I need to sort of claim a role or a place in the common and speak to common concerns and gather with others to identify and address these common concerns. And when that happens, Woolen thinks, these are fugitive democratic moments, right? When that happens, we get a sense for the possibilities of being political. We get a sense for the possibilities of shaping ourselves as political beings. And we can't sustain those forever, right? Sometimes these things lead to victory, sometimes they lead to defeats. We can't sustain the political forever. Difference, he says, reasserts itself. But the memory of that experience, the moment of that experience, can sort of leave its trace, and we sort of shape ourselves into and become these political beings, sensitive to further additional opportunities for that sort of engagement, participation, etc.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. David McIver joins me. He teaches political science at Colorado State University. His primary research interests are democratic theory and contemporary political theory, and we are talking about an article he wrote about the political theorist Sheldon Woolen for the journal New Political Science. The article is entitled The Conscience of a Fugitive, Sheldon Woolen and the Prospects for Radical Democracy. Sheldon Woolen was a theorist and writer and public intellectual who died on October 21st, 2015 at the age of 93. He taught at UC Berkeley for more than a dozen years, and later he moved in 1972 to Princeton, where he taught until his retirement in 1987. And David has mentioned his book, his very high-profile book, one of many he wrote. It was entitled Democracy Incorporated, Managed Democracy and the Specter of Inverted Totalitarianism. So you, in this article, are appealing to, are calling upon three kinds of themes. One is invocation. We've talked a little bit about that. The second is threat, and the third is ambivalence. And if we move to democratic threat, you begin this section of your paper by talking about neoliberalism as a system and the extent to which Woolen was troubled by it. And maybe, you know, we've had a lot of thinkers on this program talking about neoliberalism. Can you give us your kind of thumbnail definition of what it is?
You know, my interpretation is I think somewhat similar to Woolen's interpretation, which is that neoliberalism is actually pretty old. I think Woolen would categorize Alexander Hamilton as a neoliberal thinker avant la lettre, right? You know, before the term actually appears. But neoliberalism is more or less the intensification of modern power into superpower, right? Neoliberalism is the sort of explicit joining of state power to capital accumulation. Neoliberalism is sort of suffused with these norms and an ethos of aggrandizement, advance, competition, entrepreneurialism, hyper-individualism. And all of these things, Woolen thinks, have a corrosive effect on democracy. So the way in which special interests or big companies have found a way to translate their economic advantage into political advantage is one of the ways in which this has sort of intensified from liberalism into neoliberalism. But it's also sort of had a cultural effect in how citizens, how individuals think of themselves, think of society, think of their role within society, and think about democracy. So neoliberalism is in many ways pretty old for Wohlen. But again, in the post-World War II era, and especially after 1980, these trends intensify to the extent where he evokes this specter of inverted totalitarianism, where neoliberalism comes to see itself as very comfortable with kind of a managed democracy, a passive citizenry, mostly engaged in the work of economic productivity and production and consumption, and just not interested in participation, except for kind of symbolic participation in the power of the economy and the power of the state.
So, you know, one could, as you say, live kind of passively and not really try and understand what's really going on with the political, economic, cultural system that surrounds us and that has kind of taken over so many aspects of our lives. How important was it to Wohlen that we grasp what the power structure is, what the system of power is, so that we can respond to it in an appropriate way?
Well, yeah. So in the paper, I put it this way. I say you have to know your enemy to know yourself. Right. So Wohlen thinks that we have to sort of catalog and be consciously aware of the forces that are pushing and pulling us, both constraining our action, but also enticing us. Right. So he talks about sort of the enticements of Madison Avenue and consumer society, which is a part of neoliberalism. Right. That where we can experience power and agency is in the marketplace, either by participating in the marketplace as entrepreneurs or producers, or going on Etsy and selling our own stuff, right, creating our own stuff, or through consumption, that you can consume your way to agency and power, or that consumption is itself a form of agency or power. So Wohlen says we need to understand how that's sort of an ersatz, you know, kind of fake, false form of agency or power. It actually diverts us from the possibility of actually having democratic power, kratos, right, the kratos, the capacity to act in the world. So we have to know our enemy to know ourselves. Democracy is a fighting creed, Wohlen would say. Democracy, you know, requires certain commitments, emphasizes, forwards certain norms. And insofar as those norms, insofar as the habits that would embody those norms, are made fugitive or are pushed to the side or are marginalized, we have to understand the forces that are doing that work of marginalization. So this is why I say that the register of threat is that we sort of have to know the forces that are arrayed against us so that we can fight adequately and effectively against them.
His name is David McIver. He teaches political science at Colorado State University. We'll take a short break and speak more with David McIver about the political theorist Sheldon Wohlen and his ideas and what David thinks of those ideas. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. David McIver, his last name is spelled M-C-I-V-O-R, is assistant professor of political science at Colorado State University. He's author of Morning in America, Race and the Politics of Loss, which just came out in December from Cornell University Press. He also co-edited the volume Democratizing Deliberation. And we are focusing on an article he wrote about the political theorist Sheldon Wolin and the prospects for radical democracy that appeared in the journal New Political Science. We have links to David's book, as well as to New Political Science, as well as to his faculty page at Colorado State University on our website, againstthegrain.org. Well, David, you've begun answering this question, but let me ask if mourning democracy as a threatened and often defeated object of attachment, so that's the invocation, plus naming the current threats to democratic aspirations and practices, which is kind of the threat register part of your article, whether that is enough to revive democracy in times like this.
Well, one never knows. One never knows in advance. The sort of specter, political theorist specter behind Wolin and much of Wolin's writing is Alexis de Tocqueville. Wolin wrote a book, I think it came out in 2004, Tocqueville Between Two Worlds. It's a 550-page book. I mean, a really extensive reading of Tocqueville. And I think Tocqueville had this ambivalent attitude towards democracy. He thought democracy was a providential fact. It was happening in the world. It was defeating aristocratic forms of life. And the question is, what kind of democracy are you going to get? What is the character and quality of democracy that you're going to get? And Wolin sort of embodies a lot of that same ambivalence towards democracy. He thinks of democracy as probably the most important carrier of the political, or this reminder that we can have the capacity to be concerned about and to care for the common. But there's a lot of other not so great aspects of democracy. But Wolin, at the end of the day, is optimistic. He says the promise of democracy is the promise that what he calls cultural patterns of commonality can be created at any time. Right, that citizens can create cultural patterns of commonality at any time. Again, Wolin thinks that difference is stable. Our difference from each other, or even our differences within ourselves, is sort of what's stable in the world. Commonality, a kind of commonality of purpose, this ability to concert powers together, is actually fairly rare. And it's difficult. But he thinks it's always possible. And he thinks it's always possible. And this is, again, why the free speech movement 60s in the Berkeley was so impressive for Wolin. In fact, he describes it as a moment when he shifted from liberalism to democracy. This idea that these are people that were claiming and reclaiming the common, right? And being concerned for and caring for the common. So he was very much inspired by that and inspired by other similar democratic moments throughout history. So there's always this chance for Wolin. I mean, this is why I think we misread Wolin when we see him as this despairing theorist of democracy and inverted totalitarianism and all is darkness. These cultural patterns of commonality can be created and recreated at any time, Wolin says. Doesn't mean it's easy. And it's, in fact, very difficult, and we would not expect it. But it's possible.
If the experience of the political, according to Wolin, occurs when people come together and discover commonality, create commonality, then what do we make of moments like the aftermath of 9/11, where you had this patriotic fervor that one could say created a kind of commonality among lots of people?
Yeah, so not all moments of commonality are created equal. Wolin thinks about the aftermath of 9/11 in terms of what he calls imperial citizenship. Now, the sort of spontaneous sense of, you know, the homeland has been struck and America needs to mourn, and the sense of we should get involved and we should be, you know, involved in our communities and we're feeling for the people that are affected by this tragedy. Wolin thinks that sort of spontaneous response is the potential, right? Potential for sort of authentic moments of commonality. Wolin thought it was sort of diverted through this idea of managed democracy. And the president of the time, George Bush, sort of reflected this for Wolin. He was very critical of this in his book, Democracy Incorporated, that what citizens should do is go back to participating in the economy, right? So spend money, take flights, show that we're not afraid, these sorts of activities, rather than calling people to sort of engage in the work of improving the common in their communities, right? Improving their communities around them, responding and channeling this sort of surge of solidarity and feelings of common purpose towards political ends. They were sort of channeled towards anti-political ends. So I think Wolin would see the immediate aftermath of 9/11 as a real opportunity for the possibility of shaping ourselves into political beings and developing and redeveloping political habits. But it was an opportunity missed.
So you have this imperial citizenship, and then you have what Wolin refers to as the multiple civic self, which I assume brings in the kind of ambivalence that you have been emphasizing, the ambivalence that he has even toward certain aspects of democracy, toward certain democratic moments that he would like us perhaps to remember. Talk about what a multiple civic self is.
Yeah, so again, much of Wolin's work is sort of dedicated to painting a fairly bleak picture about the obstacles of democracy and the way in which democracy has been excluded or marginalized, I guess I should say, from our quote-unquote democratic, within our democratic political traditions. But Wolin thinks that there are ways in which citizens can sort of recapture what he calls the birthright of politicalness, that we can sort of take on and inherit this birthright of politicalness. And there's an idea, and I probably make more of this idea than Wolin himself did, but I feel this was a really promising moment in Wolin's work that he didn't really fully develop. And part of this essay and in some other work that I've written about Wolin is trying to think what they're trying to flesh out and think more fully about this idea. This is what he calls the multiple civic self. So again, for Wolin, if we only associate and identify with politicalness through the formal political system, political parties, elections, etc., then we stand a risk of sort of sliding quickly into this imperial citizenship. Or at best, we sort of take on the norms of this kind of adversarial politics where it's about protecting the particularities of our group, right? Protecting the particularities of our partisan affiliation. So then Wolin says, okay, well, how can we come to really experience politicalness? How can we come to think about ourselves as political beings? And he says the primary way we can do this is to get involved with the controversies, questions, concerns immediately around us, right? So Wolin says that the locality, right, the township, you know, in Tocqueville's time, the village, right, that these spaces, our local spaces, are the spaces where we can kind of steep ourselves most deeply in politicalness, right, in a sense for what are the concerns or issues of the common, right? How can we care for and improve that which is common between us, our collective lives together? And then how can we negotiate the ambivalences, you know, the differences, the conflicts, the contestation that we're inevitably going to encounter? Because again, Wolin thinks that, you know, we're different to ourselves. We're certainly different from those around us, right? The space of politics is not a space of unanimity. It's not a space of consensus. It's a space of difference, right? The work of the political is the work of trying to identify and forge and create common ground or commonality. So Wolin thinks that in our local environments, we can do this best. Now, the locality in and of itself is insufficient, right? Local politics is insufficient for Wolin, and this goes back to the register of threat that we talked about earlier, because the forces arrayed against democracy, the forces sort of marginalizing political ways of being, exceed the bounds of any locality, right? Fort Collins, Berkeley, San Francisco, etc. So that's why Wolin talks about this idea of what he calls the multiple civic self, that we have to develop a way of being in the world where we sort of educate ourselves, educate our political being in the space around us, develop a particular civic skill set that we can best do in the space around us. But then we take and deploy that civic skill set at the state level, at the regional level, at the national level, at the international level. So it's not quite, you know, think globally, act locally, but it's a similar species for Wolin.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. David McIver is his name. He's assistant professor of political science at Colorado State University. And we are talking about his reflections on the late political theorist Sheldon Wolin and what Wolin thought about a democracy and its prospects and the kind of the current state of power and power arrangements in this nation, and you know, Dave's impressions of those and his interpretation specifically of something called fugitive democracy, something that Sheldon Wolin put forward and got a lot of pushback against by various theorists who decided it was too dark and despairing. You also refer in this article to myths and myth-making and democratic myths. Can you enlighten us on what you mean here and talk about how myths and kind of buying into certain myths and national myths might discourage the recognition of ambiguity and our ability to develop these multiple civic selves?
Yeah, so this is a somewhat complex element of Wolin's thinking, which he doesn't elaborate on extensively. But he basically says that democracy doesn't have a lot of accompanying myths. And the reason for that is that myths, by their nature, seem to exclude sort of nuance and complexity. So take a classic myth in American political tradition, the sort of myth of the American dream, right? The capacity to sort of pull yourself up by your bootstraps, and no matter where into what circumstances you're born, you know, you can make it by striving hard enough. And that's sort of a functional myth. Tocqueville talks about this. He says it's functional because it lends such an energy to American society, right? This idea that you can sort of achieve greatness if you strive hard enough and if you work hard enough creates this incredible bustling energy in American society, which Tocqueville thinks has some good effects. So he sees it as kind of a functional myth, but we have to acknowledge that it's a myth. In fact, there's been some recent studies, economists have shown that social mobility is sort of ground to a halt in this country, and we're far behind many, many other advanced industrial democracies in social mobility, the idea that you can move, change from the social status situation of your parents to where you end up. So as a myth, it sort of excludes that, though, right? It excludes the sort of nuance and complexity that is being shown by these economic reports, right? You just can't sort of include it within the myth itself. And the myth remains functional. So Wolin says democracy doesn't really have a lot of myths associated with it because democracy is itself ambivalent. And I can illustrate this by going back to Tocqueville, because Tocqueville says democracy unleashes certain forces that are actually bad for democracy. So democracy in democratic ages, Tocqueville says, democratic ages are individualistic ages. He says individualism is a new word that I had to invent for a new phenomenon, because in aristocratic eras, the idea that you're the standalone individual separated from your descendants and your ancestors is just sort of unthinkable. And the effects of individualism, Tocqueville says, is that it kind of draws us closer and closer into our own individual. We withdraw from the public world. We withdraw from common concerns, and we get wrapped up in our own individual idiosyncratic democratic concerns and lives. So democracy gives rise to a force which is potentially antithetical, or at least in conflict or in tension with democracy, considered as this, or conceived as this concern for and care for the common, right? Inequality is another thing. So Tocqueville thinks that Americans have relatively equal social conditions in the 19th century, with the exception of slavery, which he dedicates one of the longest chapters in the book to. But he says inequality can grow within a democracy, right? He sees the potential for this dawning of what he calls an industrial aristocracy, right? With sort of the winners of the economic competition pass on that advantage to the next generation, and the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. So democracy unleashes forces that are potentially antithetical, or at very least in tension with democracy itself. So democracy is ambivalent, right? It's not the sort of pristine object of identification and attachment. And Wolin says we can see this in a lot of the fugitive democratic moments that we talk about. There's a lot of ugly features of these fugitive democratic moments, the sort of racism of the populist moment or movement for Wolin, right? This idea that the populist movement in and of itself is this incredible movement by which the demos, the people, attempt to have and express kratos, the capacity to act in the world, but incredibly racist in a lot of respects. So even these democratic moments, these fugitive democratic moments, have some ambivalence within them, which means that it's hard to kind of build up myths about democracy, because democracy is ambivalent, it's nuanced, it's complex. And Wolin thinks we have to identify with that complexity. We have to identify with that ambivalence. That's part of the sort of political educative work of shaping ourselves into political beings.
What did Sheldon Wolin write in 2000 about our society's ability to face up to the damage to democracy that he understood had occurred?
Yeah, well, so just as Wolin doesn't think that we are primed by our political tradition to accept and identify with ambivalence and complexity and nuance, Wolin doesn't think that we are primed by our political and cultural traditions to really dwell with loss. America is sort of this aspirational country, future-oriented country. And Wolin sees this embodied in not just in our political tradition, but certainly in messages emanating from Madison Avenue and consumer society, right? That you can leave the past behind. You can become a brand new you. So there's sort of this anti-traditionalism baked into American political and cultural traditions, which is kind of ironic, an anti-traditionalist tradition, but it's what we have. So Wolin doesn't think that we really are primed to deal with loss, that we're primed to think about our lives and think about our politics in terms of loss. And for Wolin, again, what's really been lost, or what political theory focuses on that's been lost, is this sense of politicalness, right? Is this sense that we can know and value how to participate in and be responsible for the common and the collective, right? And we can develop skill sets for doing that sort of work. So that's why, again, this register of invocation for calling these things back to our attention, right? For remembering these things, bringing these things back into our consciousness. But there are some headwinds against this kind of work. And in my book, which you've mentioned a few times, I talk about this a little bit. I mean, the Reagan-era slogan, it's morning in America, right? The idea is that, you know, Americans get up every morning and are ready to sort of meet the future and reach for their goals, aspire towards greatness. And we're not sort of burdened by the past, or we leave the past behind, right? You know, even Bob Dylan says, you know, leave the dead you've left, they will not follow you. So this idea of moving on, of getting past loss, of not dwelling on loss, is kind of deeply ground into our political and cultural DNA. And that's one of the sort of forces that Wolin is trying to fight against.
Right. And so you're focusing on invocation, and that's a form of mourning with a U, MOURNING, in this piece. And you have written a book called Mourning with a U in America. How did you get interested in the phenomenon of mourning and the political potential of mourning practices?
Well, I mean, partly it starts from reading Sheldon Wolin, and this invocation piece that he wrote in 2000, From Vocation to Invocation, really struck me as a graduate student. And I started exploring this idea of the politics of mourning. And it's sort of patently obvious, at least to me, of course I wrote a book about it, that politics is intertwined with mourning, right? That there's a politics of mourning, and that mourning is intertwined with politics, right? So the question of who and what gets mourned, which losses get acknowledged or recognized in a society, is a really important political question, right? Which losses are seen as valid losses? The losses of factories, are those seen as valid losses? The losses of immigrants about to be deported, whose losses are we going to take seriously and honor and recognize? Is an important political question. So I started getting into that and thinking more seriously about that. And as I was doing that, I was a graduate student in Durham, North Carolina at Duke University. And in Greensboro, North Carolina at this time, there was a really interesting civic experiment in what I call democratic mourning. There was a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, a grassroots organized Truth and Reconciliation Commission that ran for about 2.5 years, 2004 to 2006-ish in Greensboro, focusing on what's been called the Greensboro Massacre of 1979, which was this event in which members of the KKK rolled into town and interrupted a protest march shot and killed 5 activists associated with the Communist Workers' Party in Greensboro. And the city of Greensboro really tries to distance itself from this event and from the people involved in this event, saying it has nothing to do with Greensboro. But it was clearly kind of a traumatic event in the city's life, and it sort of festers as a wound in Greensboro for a long time. And 25 years after the event, grassroots organizations come together to create and fund a Truth and Reconciliation Commission about this event. And this, to me, represents an opportunity or a moment. I might say it's a fugitive moment, to invoke Wolin, a fugitive moment when citizens, when a community kind of comes together to try to acknowledge and face down a traumatic event in its history and sort of the lingering after effects of that event. And what does that look like? And what does that do for citizens? What does it do for the sense of being a citizen of Greensboro, a resident of Greensboro? What does that do for a sense of democratic citizenship? So those are sort of the questions that I explore in the book. But I see it as the sort of argument I'm making is that it's paramount to think about loss in a democracy and think about what gets mourned, but also how we mourn, how we commemorate, how we acknowledge death, how we acknowledge certain losses, how we acknowledge these traumatic events.
The book, again, is Mourning in America, Race and the Politics of Loss. The author and my guest today is David McIver. He teaches political science at Colorado State University. He's a scholar of democratic theory. And again, in New Political Science, he wrote a piece. This is the September issue. He wrote a piece about Sheldon Wolin, the political theorist, and what Wolin thought about democracy and its prospects and how power operates today. David, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, it's been a great pleasure to speak with you, and I really appreciate your questions.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.